Today's Teisho will be on Case 20 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Man of Great Strength. Shogen Osho asked, why is it that a man of great strength does not lift his legs? And he also said, it is not the tongue he speaks with. Mumon's comment, it must be said that Shogen shows us all his stomach and intestines, but alas, no one can appreciate him. And even if someone could appreciate him, let him come to me and I'll beat him with this stick. Why? If you want to find pure gold, you must see it through the fire. Mumon's verse, lifting his leg, he kicks up the scented ocean. Lowering his head, he looks down on the fourth dhyana heaven. There is no space vast enough for his body. Now, somebody write the last line here. Shogen Osho asked, why is it that a person of great strength cannot lift his leg? It's another way to translate this. Why is it that a person of great strength cannot lift his legs? I suppose we've all had the experience of being blocked, not knowing what to do next. One way to understand this koan is to see it about that experience. In your Zen practice, for example, you may be working on a koan, and it's possible that you've been working on it for some time, and you don't feel that you're really getting anywhere with your practice. Maybe you've been working with a koan for a month, or 2 months, or 3 months. Maybe you've been working with a koan for a year. You may come to sesshin, and you may apply yourself, but you may feel that you're blocked. That feeling of being blocked is something everyone who does Zen understands very well. After you work your way through the Mu Koan, usually people have high expectations about the future. It often takes about 5 years, maybe a little less, to work through the Mu Koan. And after all of that work, there's usually quite a big breakthrough. And then people feel it can't be that hard again, so on to the next koan. And the teacher gives you a koan, and you think this is going to be smooth sailing from here on in. And then you start working with the koan, and lo and behold, there's that old feeling again, which is not necessarily a very pleasant feeling, of being blocked. Being blocked. You want a certain result. You want to be able to go into the teacher and say, ah yes, the answer is, or do something, make a presentation, and the teacher will go, wonderful, wonderful, your Dharma eye is wide open. This is the dream. And the reality is you go into the teacher and you don't really have anything to say in Dokusan. It's an unpleasant situation. You sit on the cushion and it's like it just won't come. I make my living as a teacher of English and as I write also. And some days, you know, you can just get up and you can have your computer on, and the desk is cleared, there's the mug of coffee by the computer, and there's the notepad and the sharpened pencils, And you've set the time aside, and you sit down, and nothing happens, and nothing happens. And you grind away, you write this, you write that, you know, you erase it, you're writing longhand, you throw the paper in the trash. This can go on for hours. It's like, where is it? Why won't it come? And this happens to everybody. Everybody has this this kind of experience, you know, being blocked. I wrote a dissertation when I was in graduate school to get my PhD. I had to complete a dissertation. And I was in a dissertation workshop. In other words, graduate students who were trying to finish their dissertations all got together and would read chapters from each other's dissertations and offer criticism. And partly it was just a self-help community, because we would all get together and it was a way of commiserating with each other. We were trying to finish our dissertations, and a number of people in the group were really blocked. You know, they wanted to get this process finished, but they found it very hard to write. You know, the inspiration just wasn't coming, you could say. And it's not just it's not just in fields like that. You know, some of you may be fans of the great Tiger in golf. And, you know, sometimes he's on, you know, just amazingly on. And sometimes he's not. Everybody's rooting for him, but the lightning just doesn't strike. You know, he's blocked. And it seems to me that a lot of Zen practice is about dealing with this experience, learning how to deal with this experience, how to deal with this experience. We want to get from point A to point B. But somehow it's not possible, always possible, to do that. And it's very unpleasant, very uncomfortable situation. I was away earlier in the week because I was attending a conference in the beautiful California, beautiful area of near Santa Barbara. And it was so interesting. It's always interesting to go to these conferences, because there's so many people who are really quite intelligent, and they're doing interesting things. I don't know if you have ever been to a conference, but you know, generally, what happens is that in any particular field, there are papers are presented by researchers in different fields, and there's usually panels of presentations. So, if the conference starts on a Monday, there might be a speaker who's a major speaker. And that person speaks for maybe 45 minutes, and then there's a break, and then you have smaller sessions all day, and there are panels that are consecutive panels running all day. So at any particular time, you might be able to go to three different panels if you wish, or choose from three different panels. And so you can go into this auditorium room or this room and listen to this panel. Speaker one gives a paper, speaker two gives a paper, speaker three gives a paper, and they're usually related somehow. And then you can, you know, that period is over, and you can go to another panel the next period. And you can go to another panel the next period. And then it's time for lunch, and then the same thing. And the whole purpose of these conferences is to help people educate themselves. So you might not have time to read everything, so you go to a conference and you look at the conference. There's usually some kind of a printed guide to the panels, and you find some panels that sound interesting or that or doing something you're doing research in. And you go to that panel, people take notes, you learn a lot. You know. And so this is what I was up to. As a person who's lived his life in Zen, I always go to these panels with sort of mixed feelings, because I find them very interesting, but I don't necessarily buy into the whole project of philosophy or criticism. So I sort of feel like an outsider visiting a conference, a little bit. And it's so interesting to go to these panels, because the panels are often filled with people who share common values. So if there's a panel and it's on, say, well, it might be on a particular philosopher's approach to meaning. And people on the panel will all have read this philosopher. And they'll each be talking about, say, poetry or a novel or drama in terms of this philosopher's work. This is how it goes. So you go in and you go to the panel, and they've all read this great philosopher. They all sort of are like true believers in the philosopher. He's got the key to the universe. And they show how his work helps us to understand this poem, this poetry, or this novel. And it's like a religion, really. You know, everybody's on the same page. Everybody pretty much believes in the work of the great whoever. And they love it, and it's marvelous. It's like the key to the universe. And so the conversations are wonderful. They all share common values, common insights. And they help each other work through problems. This is like one of the best things about human communities, that they can do this. It's wonderful to see. So you go to Philosopher A's panel, and everybody's talking about Philosopher A and how wonderful his work is or her work is, and how you can apply it to the poetry or the drama or the fiction. You know, and then you walk out, and you get a cup of coffee, and you look at the beautiful California sky, and then you go into another panel, and this one's about Philosopher B. Right? And everybody in this room thinks that Philosopher B has the key to the universe. Right? Same thing. And it's like a love fest, right? You know, we all, Philosopher B, you know, this is it. You know, this is so great. And it's like, you know, it really helps us understand this poem. It really helps us understand this novel. You know, I never understood this drama until, you know, this play, until I read Philosopher B. You know, and you know, I think Philosopher B is much better than Philosopher A, don't you think? Yes, definitely. So then, you know, you go out, it's time for lunch, you meet your friends, you have a nice lunch. Then say, are you going to go to the panel on Philosopher C? No, I don't think so. You know, but then somebody else, oh, yeah, I'll go with you. So you go to Philosopher C. Everybody here loves Philosopher C, right? Thinker number three, or Philosopher C. And they all have read all of so-and-so's works, and it really helps us understand this poem, this drama. This goes on all day long, right? And as I say, you know, this is a beautiful thing, because when humans can cooperate like this, they can really do some wonderful things. In the sciences too, you know, they work the same way. You get people who are all doing certain kind of primatology, or they're all doing work on prenatal development or something like that. And they've spent years and years all working on the same questions, and they all, this is just wonderful. It's wonderful. But it's also interesting to sort of see it as from a sort of an outsider-insider perspective. I myself don't necessarily believe in philosophy. So when I go to these panels, I think, well, that is interesting. You know, that's interesting. And then I go to panel A, and, Philosopher A, and very, it's compelling, right? It's very compelling while you're in the room. It seems to explain everything, as a matter of fact. You sit there and think, by gosh, you know, Philosopher A's really got it. You know, then you go into the second panel, you hear Philosopher B, and you think, well, you know, I thought Philosopher A really had it, but you know, Philosopher B is pretty good. Yeah? Then you go to panel number C, or panel C, rather, and you listen, my, Philosopher C is very good. You know, those two guys maybe didn't have it. Maybe it's C. See, the interesting thing to me is that each of these worlds is very compelling in itself. And they're very compelling in themselves. And when you're inside them, they seem to explain everything. This is really fascinating, you know, that just like this is really compelling to be inside Philosopher A's world, or Philosopher B's world, or Philosopher C's world. Very compelling. On the other hand, you know, you can begin to see problems, you know, if you try to get the people who are in the first panel to talk to the people in the second panel, or talk to the people. That can be a problem. And sometimes you go to a panel and it's not necessarily so persuasive. So, for example, I went to a panel on the work of a writer whose name is Cormac McCarthy, who's somebody I didn't know much about. But everybody I know who's doing work in, say, fiction, really like, a lot of people I know really like Cormac McCarthy. And he's a Southwestern writer. He writes novels usually set in the American Southwest. So I was curious about this, and one of my friends said, you know, are you interested in Cormac McCarthy? And I said, well, I don't know who he is, but I'd like to go with you to the panel. So we went to the panel, and it was, his work sounds just fascinating. And as I listened, it sounds like very different from, say, conventional Buddhism, you know. Cormac McCarthy, from what I gather, really believes that violence is central to human beings. That, you know, we try to be peace-loving beings, but basically human history is just like endless violence and total destruction, from what I can gather. And basically, he's interested in the whole rise and fall of civilizations. You know, one of these passages that one of the scholars read described Indian ruins in the Southwest. And ruins are so important for this Cormac McCarthy because they show the fate of all civilizations. All civilizations end in ruins because of violence that tears them apart. And this is sort of a distressing idea, you know, to say the least. And the interesting thing to me was that Cormac McCarthy can present it with such power and beauty. You know, some of the passages that these scholars read were so powerful and compelling and interesting and persuasive. You know, you begin to think, my gosh, it's true. You know, World War I, World War II, is there any civilization that it doesn't end up as a ruin? And you look at the violence all around us and it's like, my gosh, you know, this really is, this explains a lot. And McCarthy too is like this really interesting person. He's like a priest of art. Somebody was talking about his life, and I just thought that is so interesting. You know, he doesn't work in a university. He's never taught writing at a school of writing. He supports himself with odd jobs. For the first 10 years of his life, he lived in a barn with his first wife. I think he's had a number of wives because of the way he lives, you know. Or because of his philosophy, I don't know. If you believe violence is inescapable, you might not be a very good partner in a marriage, you know. But, you know, for the first 10 years of his life, apparently, he did odd jobs, and he lived in a barn with his wife, and they didn't have a shower. They used to go out in the lake near the barn and bathe in the lake. And basically, he's devoted all of his time, day in and day out, to writing these extraordinarily beautiful works of fiction that are just the passages that these authors read, I mean, I'm going to take a look at his fiction because it's so interesting and so beautiful. And yet the message is so disturbing, you know, violent, the inevitability of destruction, the human heart is basically violent. You know, and I think what he's saying is that we have to recognize violence as part of our nature, and I'm not sure if he thinks that would solve anything, but... And again, you know, I'm sitting there, and this is all so compelling. When you're inside Cormac McCarthy's mind, it all makes so much sense. And that's the interesting thing to me, that, you know, when you're in Derrida's mind, it all makes sense. When you're in Sartre's mind, it all makes sense. When you're in William Faulkner's mind, it all makes sense. Always very compelling. But you know, you go from panel to panel to panel, and you realize that all of these views are internally consistent and very persuasive when you're in them. But, you know, you can't stay in the panel forever. See? You can't stay in the panel forever. You have to go get lunch. You have to go get dinner. And you have to go to your hotel. And it's like on the way from the panel to the hotel, things stop being so consistent. You know what I mean? See, you know, when I was a kid, I was sort of a social isolate, as they say. You know, in other words, I grew up on military bases where if you weren't into sports, you were likely to get beaten up, you know, basically. So since I wasn't any good at sports, and in order not to get beaten up, you know, basically I just stayed in my room and read these books. And that was wonderful for me. You know, I would read a book, and I would go into like a dream world, right? And then I would be in there for hours. Sometimes I would read from morning till afternoon. I would get a book like, I used to read these books by a man named Lawrence Durrell. He's gone out of style, but when I first read his, he has a book he has some books called The Alexandria Quartet, which I thought were incredible until I got to college and I told one of my professors, I said, yes, I really love Lawrence Durrell. And my professor said something like Durrell was like a dime store writer or something like that. So yeah, that's a dime store version of reality. It was like, what? Oh, you know, I saw I wasn't supposed to like him. But I read his work when I was a kid, and it was set in Egypt before World War I, very exotic, well, I thought sophisticated characters. It's sort of like Casablanca, like the movie Casablanca. Now, you know, I would read that, and all the things that surrounded me would just disappear, and I'd be in this beautiful imaginary realm. And then, you know, and in that realm, everything was so coherent and beautiful and wonderful. And it was so different from life on the base, the military base where I lived, which was so sort of raw and tough and unpleasant and ugly, really. You know, military bases are often just physically ugly places, especially like Navy bases. So, you know, I would be in this beautiful dream, and then I'd have to come out, and everything would get messy. You know, because life isn't really like a work of art in a certain way, you know. It doesn't have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And events don't really have the relationship to one another that they do in fiction. So, you know, in fiction there's a device called foreshadowing, where maybe you're about to go through a catastrophe that will shatter your world, and in the story, before all of that happens, you'll drop your glass and it will shatter, see? And artists love this kind of thing because, see, this foreshadows the events to come, right? And, you know, but in life, it's not like that, you know? It doesn't have that kind of coherence. And as long as you can stay in the dream, it's okay, but the difficult parts are going from panel A to panel B to panel C. See, it's the transitions that are the problem for us as human beings. Because when you leave beautiful philosopher A and you go out into the lobby, you realize you've left your program, your list of panels, back at your hotel room. And then you think, darn it, I've got to get another program. So you walk around the lobby looking for programs, and they're out of programs. So you have to go down to the first floor and you ask for a program, but that's $5, right? So then, you know, you have to pay another $5 for another program. And by then you're late for the first speaker of the second panel, and so on. Or you realize you've left your hotel, you've left your notebook back at the hotel or something. You know, the transitions are the hard part. This is like life, I think. You know, we like these systems that make things coherent, make things real for us, and coherent in a kind of imaginary way. And we want to get from this dream to this dream to this dream very smoothly. But it's never smooth. You know, the transitions are very difficult for us. But the transitions, I think, are where we get a different perspective, you know, a bigger perspective. You can go to panel A and hear philosopher A, and it's so compelling. And then, you know, you could just go home and you could start reading philosopher A, and you could build your life around that guy's ideas. But if you go to the next panel, you realize, you know, I thought philosopher A had it all, but I see there's something else here. And then you go to the next, each time you go to a panel, you realize, you know, that wasn't everything after all. So I think we learn a lot by going to lots of panels. Each time we go into the room, we think we've found the answer, you know, but then you go to the next room and you realize this is another set of answers. And to me, you know, it's the thing I value most is that experience of knowing that the first panel didn't have all the answers. And then I kind of know, you know, this one probably doesn't either. And so then the interesting thing is the transitions, right? Because they offer something that the panels don't offer. They offer, like, bigger perspective. But we have to be able to tolerate the transitions. You have to be able to tolerate those transitions. You have to be comfortable with those transitions. One way to think of koan practice is that they teach us how to be comfortable with the transitions, right? You know, we all come to every koan thinking we have it. You know, I've got the system down. I passed the mu koan. I finally understand what this Buddhism stuff is all about. I think I'm getting an understanding of what this Zen is all about. See? And then the teacher gives you a koan, and damn it, you're back in the same blankness again. You're back in that transition. And things just don't come together in the transitions the way they do when you're in the panel. And I just think this is great. Because this is your chance to find something new, to learn something new, if you can tolerate it, you know, if you can tolerate the uncertainty. But it's so important. It's so important. Because these little panels get to be a prison house in a way, I think. There's a real danger when you think, you know, philosopher A has got it all. He's got it all. And you run into somebody who says, no, no, philosopher B has got it all. Oh, no, my friend. You know, it's A. Oh, no, it's B. You know, and this is human history. I mean, maybe McCarthy is right. You know, maybe violence is our inevitable fate. But I think the persistence of violence in human history has a lot to do with our being unable to deal with those spaces between the panels. Now, you go to 20 panels, you realize none of these guys have the answer. Nobody has the answer totally. You get to see the bigger picture if you go to a lot of panels, but you won't go to a lot of panels if you don't learn to tolerate the spaces, the intervals between them. And so Zen practice, one way to think about it, is learning how to live in those spaces, those open spaces. Now, you know, there are people who say there's no such thing as open spaces. You're either with philosopher A, philosopher B, philosopher C. You've got to be with some philosopher. You know, what I'd like to say is please don't believe that. And somebody might say, well, and you yourself are a philosopher, even though you claim not to be. And this is a philosophy, you know. Yeah, I don't think it's so. I actually don't think it's so. I want to read you something, which is not a work of philosophy. It's an excerpt from an article in the journal Nature. The beauty of one of Japan's most popular Zen gardens has long eluded explanation. Now neuroscientists have found that its minimalist design suggests a pleasing picture to our subconscious. The 500-year-old Ryoanji Temple Garden in Kyoto contains 5 outcroppings of rock and moss on a rectangle of raked gravel. Using symmetry calculations, the researchers have discovered that the objects imply an image of a tree in the empty space between them that we detect without being aware of doing so. The findings suggest that Japanese garden designers, Zen priests, balanced forces from visual science, says study leader Gert von Tonder of Kyoto University. The trunk of the hidden branched tree lines up with the preferred garden viewing spot of ancient temple floor plans, von Tonder found. Repeating the calculations with random rock groups failed to generate any similar patterns. Earlier work by Ilona Kovac, a visual scientist at Rutgers University in Piscataway, New Jersey, showed that the human brain uses similar symmetry lines, like those of a child's stick figure, to make sense of shapes. In the Zen garden, you have even less to go on with just the best points or rocks along the symmetry lines, says Kovac. She suggests the brain may recognize the tree during meditation and other Zen states. Through the years, people have come up with various interpretations for the rock clusters themselves. A mother tiger herding her cubs across a river, mountaintops poking through the clouds, and strokes of Chinese characters. These logical descriptions miss the point, says Philip Cave, a London-based Japanese garden designer. He thinks the suggestive symmetry explanation fits the Zen mind better. It's always been thought that the priest gardener's layout was something that didn't come from the conscious mind, but from a deeper level, says Cave. They could have easily, intuitively developed that kind of tree layout. The garden, like Mona Lisa's smile, has intrigued visitors for centuries. Tour guides bringing visitors to the best spot to view the garden stop exactly where the cemetery lines converge. Now, I think that's really, really interesting. Because what, if I understand that article correctly, what it's saying is that the design of the garden, when it's properly experienced, doesn't speak to our discriminating mind, our little mind. It's to what we call big mind, deeper mind. See? Now, my feeling is that philosopher A speaks to discriminating intellect. Philosopher B, discriminating intellect. Philosopher C, discriminating intellect. And in that setting, you know, very powerful, very, very, very engaging, very persuasive. But those are not the only ways to experience reality. That we have this other capacity to experience reality through big mind, through the unconscious. And that's what we do when our systems fail, see. You go to panel A, very, very interesting, very compelling. Panel B, very interesting. Panel C, but you say, which one should I believe? Because they were all compelling when I was in them. See? And my feeling is that's a kind of decision that can't be made by the discriminating mind. You have to draw on the bigger mind, deeper mind. And when you begin to encounter incoherence in panel A and panel B, and B, you've got to go somewhere else. Where do you go? My feeling is go to your bigger mind. Go to your bigger mind. So the decisions that are really important in life, we can't make with a little mind. See? And the other problem with a little mind is that you can't see the problems when you're inside it. You can't see the limits when you're inside it. Little mind always works by excluding what doesn't make sense in its own viewpoint. Right? So you start with what you want to say and you figure out how to say it. So there are no transitions inside that little mind. See? But, you know, life isn't like that. It's full of inconsistencies and contradictions all the time. It isn't linear. It isn't actually isn't logical. We use logic, but we use logic to understand. But logic isn't. But life is not actually logical. Only parts of life are logical. You know, so when we live in the panel world, the little panel world, you know, it's necessary, beneficial, good, inspiring, but limiting in ways that are really problematic, I think. There's another way to live. There's a way to learn how to live in the transitions, in the transitions. And that's the Zen life. So, you know, when you feel blocked in your practice, first of all, let me just say, whenever you're unhappy with your practice, I swear to you, the solution is more practice. Really and truly. You know, if you're not happy with what's happening on the cushion, please do more zazen. And you won't be disappointed. It's like if you're uneasy with the transitions, don't, you know, it's probably better not to go to the next panel. Just sit in the lobby for a while and watch people pass by. So more zazen, but also, you know, you have to get used to the incoherence. You have to get used to the experience of openness, which is central to this life. Central to this life. And people are not necessarily comfortable without an answer, you know? They don't like not having the answer. But not having the answer is a wonderful condition. Because when the little mind is stumped, the big mind can become activated. All kinds of wonderful insights, all kinds of wonderful things become possible. I wanted to read you something by a great Zen master of the Tang Dynasty. This is by Yuan Wu. Yuan Wu, or Japanese said Engel. He's the author of the Blue Rock Collection. These were letters he wrote to Zen students. And this is entitled, Walking on the Ground of Reality. For the sake of this great teaching, the ancients gave up their bodies and their lives and endured endless, immeasurable hardship and toil until they thoroughly clarified its profound, essential message. They treasured it like a precious jewel and guarded it like their eyes. They worked on it assiduously and never let it be taken lightly or defiled. As soon as the slightest trace of special understanding arises, it is like clouds casting a pall over a clear sky, like dust obscuring the surface of a mirror. Thus Zhao Zhu said, when I was in the South for 30 years, except at meal times, I never used my mind in a way that mixed in worldly concerns. Kaoshan instructed people to guard this matter as carefully as if they were passing through a village with poisoned wells, and not to let a single drop of the poisoned water touch them. By forgetting conditioned mind and cutting off conditioned awareness, you arrive in practice at the true realm of pure presence. There is nothing on your mind and no mind on anything. You are calm and free from all contrived action as you move through life. Only when you yourself walk upon the ground of reality can you help people by dissolving sticking points and removing bonds. You liberate everyone, even though there is really no one to liberate and nothing to be liberated from. You must put the last word to use. Then you will have a way out everywhere, in everything. So this is a high standard, right? This is living in the transitions. In other words, what Zhao Zhu said was, when I was in the South for 30 years, except at meal times, I never went to any panels at all. So Zhao Zhu goes to conferences, but he doesn't go to the panels, right? He just sits in the lobby. Right? Just sits in the spaces. Right? And he said, don't even go into the room. So, this is very high standard, right? And actually, you know, at some point, it's okay to go into the room and listen to the panel. In fact, you know, people who have gone to enough panels understand that none of these panels express the truth. None of these panels express the truth. But maybe that's what Zhao Zhu meant. But the important point is that being stuck is just a misunderstanding. Just a misunderstanding. Being stuck and being free are really two versions of the same thing. Two different perspectives on the same experience. You know, that horrible experience you have of being unable to answer your koan is actually the taste of freedom. The taste of freedom. And a lot of Zen practice is just learning to enjoy that beautiful freedom, that beautiful flavor, which is at first maybe a little bitter in our mouths. But it's a wonderful thing to be, it's a wonderful thing when your true nature acts. You know, all of our lives we're trying to please others. You know, we go to panel A, and everybody says that philosopher A is the most wonderful thing in the world. And, you know, we learn, you know, okay, philosopher A, he's got it. If you say that in the panel for philosopher A, everybody's your friend, right? So if philosopher A says life is absurd, right, and you're in the panel, you say, you know, I think this proves the absurdity of life, you know, everybody's your friend, right? Is that your idea or not? Whose idea is that? You go to panel B, and that person says violence is inescapable. You stand up and say, this seems to point to the inescapability of violence. Everybody's your friend. Is that what you believe or not? See, this can go, you can live your life going from panel to panel trying to please the other people at the panel. Is it your life or is it not your life? So, I mean, my feeling is that in the spaces you have the chance to live your life, not somebody else, not, you know, years ago we used to have parties in our temple, and we all had to do performances, just you know, like we would have a party, and everybody in the at the party would have to perform some little thing, sing a song, recite a poem. So if you went to a social event at our temple, you knew you always had to do something. You know, people would do magic tricks and things like that. As we went around the room, everybody had to do something. And I remember a friend of mine, Bill Kugler, always used to recite a poem. And he did a great job reciting a poem each time. But at one point, you know, Genki Roshi actually was next to Bill when he recited this poem. And I overheard what Genki Roshi said to Bill. And he turned to Bill and he said, you know, that was a beautiful poem, but where is your poem? Where is your poem? See. And that was some exchange, probably, that I wasn't supposed to hear. And that's a Zen exchange, right? I think that had much to do with Bill's Zen, his progress in Zen practice. And I think Genki Roshi was trying to help him break free. See, that's panel A. That's not your life. That's panel B. That's not your life. That's panel C. That's not your life. So where is your poem? And you know, the poem, I think that you begin to live your life when you can live in the spaces, when you can live in the transitions, when you can live the way Zhao Zhu lived, when he said, for 30 years, I didn't have a single thought. I just lived purely in the moment. How did he put it? I didn't quite capture it. When I was in the South for 30 years, except for meals, I never used my mind in a way that engaged with worldly concerns, that was caught up in discriminating thought. For 30 years, no discriminating thought. That's a deep, in my opinion, that's the deepest way to live. Right? That's activating big mind. Now, of course, you know, you can use things from the panels to do that. So it's not necessarily either or. But you came here this morning to practice. You came here this morning to be in the spaces, to be in the transition, and the transitional place. And that's, as I say, where anything can happen, where life begins and ends. So, being blocked is not so bad, okay? Don't get too upset about it. Sit there and be blocked, and you begin to see the most wonderful things. Anything can happen in that state. Once you have a koan, you know what's going to happen next, right? And this is the best thing in the world. You answer, you go in, you see the teacher in Dokusan, you've got the answer to the koan, and the teacher does the best thing in the world. He gives you another koan. Right? So you're right back in it again, right? Why? It's so important to be in that state. You hear somebody say, I've been practicing Zen for 10 years and I still don't know what it's about. That person is practicing, right? That's wonderful. Now, if somebody says, I've really begun to get a handle on this Zen, you know they're in trouble, right? That's a terrible situation. That's, you know, we don't have a teaching stick here, but the teaching stick is for that person, right? Really and truly. You know, that's when the teacher thinks, oh my God, where's that stick, right? Quick, get the stick. Really and truly. So, thank you for coming today. Please live in the spaces. And it's wonderful being in the spaces with you.